Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chats, podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. Long time no see. And today we've got Philippe Nemacek with us, who's, Philippe, well, thanks for coming on. I'm going to say you're really an iOS developer, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. Hello, everyone. So it's crazy to be live here because, you know, I'm used to listening to that intro, but now I have to take part.
Great. Yeah. Thanks for coming on. So, as I say, you're ostensibly an iOS developer, but there's a lot more going on there. And so, yeah. Tell us a bit about your background and how come you happen to be on a Django podcast.
Do you want the full version or just like
Full version. Come on, give us the backstory.
I guess I started like programming in 2012 for around that time, and first year in college, you know, and they started us with Java and C, and you know, that wasn't super great. And then I was fortunate enough to have roommates who were in their third year, I think. So one of them suggested that I look into C#, and that was much more approachable compared to C and, you know, in Java. Also, I think the Visual Studio by Microsoft was a big factor.
Yes,
and
good idea.
I think I somehow transitioned into Windows Phone development, if anyone remembers that OS by Microsoft. I think it's dead now, but yeah, I did Windows Phone for, I think, 3 years too. I had my own apps on their store, and then my first like part-time job during school was doing Windows Phone development, and I did something with SharePoint, I don't remember, and then perhaps even .sp.net. Okay. And then, in I think late 2016, I switched to Mac because I think I had some weird issues with Windows all the time. So I decided to get the MacBook Air and started doing iOS, like still during school, just to learn it and to be able to develop mobile apps. And I think that's also when my Django like journey or like learning started, because, you know, I switched to macOS and then I realized that, you know, if I ever get a nice idea for a website or web API or whatever, I cannot build it because I only knew back then the ASP.NET, and you couldn't build it on Mac. So I was starting, you know, to look around, and I didn't want to do Java.
How did you find Django in that environment? Because you know you might have found Node, or you might have found Ruby, or you might have found.
Yes. I mean, I was sure I didn't want to do the PHP route or the JavaScript backend, so I was kind of googling around. I think perhaps something like ASP.NET alternatives or something like that, and I think I found Django like relatively quickly. It was perhaps even the first thing I tried after, you know, deciding to learn something that I could use on my on Mac. And yeah, I think I did that the initial tutorial with the Pulse app, was it back then there? Yeah. And I think my idea or like plan to learn it was to build these small projects to, you know, learn different parts of Django. But, you know, during the Pulse app, I think I've realized that I kind of understand it, and instead I've started working on my own projects, just small little things and experiments. And I think my first like real Django project was my blog that I did in 2020, I think.
Yeah, you should always code your own blog. That's the golden rule, right?
I'm not sure what my motivation was. I think it was mostly to, you know, learn more Django and to have opportunity to use it for real. And I also had some ideas for like custom stuff that either the statically generated blogs or the WordPress didn't have. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to have, you've got to have a site, you've got to have something that you can like experiment with, that you can just go, oh, I'm going to try this out and see what happens. You need a test bed.
Yeah, I just noticed on your blog, you know, the good test is go to -admin, and you have a interesting response there, but that's a good way to test if it's a Django site. I appreciate it. Sorry, are you
what you mean, but I forgot about it, and I think you're the second person to ever find it. It's like
there's an
emoji
that
repeats, you mean, or something?
It's just a single emoji, but yeah, but that's it just reminds me of, you know, because there's tools like Django Honeypot and all these things you can do, but I find it amusing that, we can say it in this podcast, like the Django project site, which gets a lot of traffic, is just dash admin when you're like on the board and everything else. No one can be bothered to switch it.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Side note.
No, you will have to switch it. Right? I mean, this is one of the security tips that I always remember, at least to change the default path. And I use different ones to just be safe.
Yeah. Sorry to interject that.
Well, no. Okay. Well, I'm just going to say, like, you do not, like, there's no point hiding the Django admin URL because the Django project site is open source. So someone could just, you know, go to GitHub.
There you
and
go. There you go.
See
there's
what
a
the
justification
URL
we
was.
Needed. Yeah. There you go. Ryan. That's
it's
true.
A bit,
that's
it
true.
Wouldn't be. It's not much to move it. Oh, secret URL.
I mean,
oh.
And it's like, what are you going to do? You're going to write a blog post for us? Like, please do. You know, like it's not. It's not like, you know, being a fellow where you can change Django itself. It's just the docs. Anyways, sorry. That's something we've done in the past on to try to find guests is we're like, I wonder if that's a Django site. And it's always dash admin, or you can go to look at dash accounts login. And that's a pretty good giveaway that it's Django. So I didn't mean to interrupt you too much. Are you just talking about your blog? And I already had it up.
I guess in 2020 and then... I think during the COVID lockdowns and, you know, this whole thing, I've started doing like more projects. And I think my first one was the Django blogs, which is just like super simple site that lists all the bloggers and links to their sites. And I was inspired by a similar one that already existed for iOS.
I think this is when I bumped into you first, Philippe. Yes, I saw you'd done that.
Yeah, that's... And then, right, slightly... After that, I did the Django feeds, which is like the RSS, say aggregator or something. It basically goes through all the blogs from the Django blogs and indexes the articles, so you can have them in one place instead of using the RSS readers.
Yeah, that's the one I came across you first. I think I even probably sent you an email. I think I saw something. Like, I don't know, I guess this feels like long ago. It must have been only 2 or 3 years ago, but that's where I saw it. And I was like, wow, this is a great resource because it has all the videos and stuff too, which
yeah,
are
Yeah, I forgot that
hard
I also did the videos and probably also podcasts.
I don't know how many active podcasts there are anymore. There were a couple, but I think...
There's at least one, right?
There's one. We keep going.
I think there's one dedicated one at this point. If there's others, let us know. Well, no, that's not fair. Django Girls... intermittently has been putting some out. And Matt Lehman, Django Riffs,
yes,
I think it's been a little bit, but he has a bunch.
I want to big up, I don't want to go over Django feeds because it's a really good resource. Like the DjangoProject.com for years has had the community aggregator, but that was in the day that was built on a third party service, which has since crumbled into dust. And so the sort of back end for the Django community aggregator is broken. And so there is no, I mean, maybe the old feeds that are still there, they might still be picked up, but new ones, they're just not validating through this, what's the remains of this third-party service. So if you want an aggregator for Django topics, Django feeds is in fact your best option. It's
just port it over to Django Project.
Well, there's that. But I want to big up that there's a resource there that we'll put a link in the show notes definitely for that.
Can I ask I don't know if you recall, but when you were switching to Django, what were the things that you liked? And there's always something that's a little confusing. Like, do you recall what was a little different?
It's been a long time ago, but I think one of the struggles was to integrate like this rich text editor or something like that, where because I wanted to have my content with like links and, you know, bold text, and I forgot how it's called.
There's a couple options. Yeah, generally, like putting either Markdown or using, there's a bunch of...
Markdown is what I'm using now for my blog and other stuff, but I use those that generate HTML directly, and that was for me pain to get it to show up in the Django admin, because back then I didn't want to build my own admin, so that was the first thing that comes to mind, and then deployment, because... No, nowadays I can sort of, you know, do it. I always go with the same steps from the DigitalOcean tutorial with the GUnicorn and Nginx and Ubuntu. But the first time it was, I think I spent like 2 days trying to get it, you know, to run on some kind of hosting, and that was difficult.
Yeah, no, you've gone through all the steps of learning Django, building your site, getting it ready, and it's like, oh, now I have to learn sys administration too. It's like, no.
I mean, I think it's a little easier on a platform as a service, but it's still, yeah, Django itself does not default to production settings. So there's a, that's something it could do to be more friendly. Like, it does have the deployment checklist, but it doesn't, the docs don't really tell you. They're not a tutorial. There are tutorials out there. I have some, others have them, but it would probably be nice if there was something in the official docs about.
I mean, even with, you know, tutorials and the detailed ones like the DigitalOcean has, it's still difficult because there is like so many configuration files, at least the route I use with the Unicorn, and then you need to create the sockets and then, you know, the point it to a project and then to handle the static files and the media files. And, you know, it's.
It depends how complex your project is, but yeah, there's a lot of steps. I mean, I constantly Google and look up stuff I wrote because, I mean, it's a checklist, right? It's like pilots flying planes. They have a checklist. Like, there's a reason it's a checklist, because it's like, I don't know, at least probably like 10 different things, and there's no real way to remember it all, and you shouldn't have to, but you're just like, oh yeah, what broke now? Anyways, so I can empathize.
But just keep complaining about that every week until someone does something about it. Philippe.
Okay, we could talk about that, but yeah.
Yeah. So you're using Django commercially, though, as the backend for your iOS app. So would you quickly tell us about, yes, your iOS apps, and then perhaps we can talk about the integration? Because I think this is a fascinating use case and, you know, lovely to talk about.
Okay.
That.
So I have a few iOS apps on the App Store, and those that are powered by API. One is called SwitchBuddy, and the other was recently released and renamed to GamingBuddy. They're very similar. SwitchBuddy is bigger. It's been on the store since 2021, and I've been gradually adding more features that then needed my own API for, like, there's a news feed that's, you know, built on the same logic and packages as the Django feeds, where it basically indexes a couple of sites that cover Nintendo news. And then I just send it to the app via the Django REST framework. And I've also added a support for a games database. I'm using the IGDB database, if anyone knows about that. It's sort of crowdsourced, like, list of all the games and, you know, the details and the release dates. So that's something I've added this year. I think perhaps in May. I don't remember the exact dates. So that's my main use case right now.
And so we're there. You pull in the sort of third party data, trim it down to the format you want, and then send it out to the app.
Yes, basically that's what I'm doing. I have my own database on the server, and I have like cron jobs that just fetch the new games or update the existing ones, and then I have my own API endpoints that, you know, basically feed the app.
Okay, and on the iOS side, you're doing that all with what's it called, UIKit or Swift UI?
It's still mostly the UIKit framework, the older one, but I'm using the Swift UI for new views and for new screens that I'm adding.
Okay, and so the question is that you're serving JSON rather than HTML,
yes,
right? So you're not using web views on the app. So then my experience there is there's kind of a bit of an impedance mismatch. You sort of, there's a lot of mapper writing. Do you find that? Do you have any tools or tricks or things that you do for them?
Yes, there's some smaller things like matching the date formats and. There's something else. Yeah, the snake case versus the, I forgot what's the other one, camel case, or like the one that Swift uses.
I can never remember the names of all these things. I think camel case.
I think Swift has pretty good support for, you know, for working with JSON without any third-party clients. You can basically create your model and conform it to this protocol that's called Codable. And if you have the same name of keys, and like the matching data attributes like number, string, and URL, you can just like parse it in two lines of code.
And it will automatically convert the snake to the camel and so on, because you give it the transformer. Fantastic. So you're really happy with the integration between what you get from the Django API and then how you're consuming it at the Swift end.
Yeah, that's been working great.
And so using REST API, Django REST framework, is that correct?
Yes.
So I had a question there. How do you like to handle authentication? Because I find that...
Yeah, that's something I'm not doing, actually. So my Django REST framework usage is like this read-only, because I don't have any user accounts in the apps. So it's just like pulling the data to display, but I don't have like this two-way communication where the app would be doing like any kind of, you know, new data creation or edits and et cetera.
Okay. Do you have a sense of, I mean, because there's JWTs were quite hot and maybe still are. Like, do you have any sense of what, I mean, because there's multiple ways to do it still. And this is actually my first DjangoCon talk was about, I was like, oh, you know, I was learning all this. And I was like, okay, time for authentication on APIs. And it was like, you know, four default methods. And it's a little bit, and then, so it's a little bit overwhelming. Maybe you don't because it's not your use case, but I'm just curious if there's a sense of a best practice these days around API authentication.
Perhaps yes, but I'm probably not the, you know, best person to ask. I think I've tried the basic, you know, the token one in the past, just, you know, to if I needed to, you know, to be able to do it, but I'm really not using any kind of auth with the REST framework.
Okay, fair enough.
I think folks are using the add-on package, the Nox, REST Nox, and REST Nox, which is the way most people are going these days, just as sort of anecdotally. So, I mean, I wonder what to ask you a little bit about, like, your choice of, do you just default on REST framework? Are you happy with it? Because it's now in a sort of maintenance mode. I mean, Tom Christie has explicitly said it's kind of feature complete, and it's perfectly stable. And one thing I think that the reasoning behind that is that they can't really make any changes without affecting people who are already using it. It's like you can't adjust, you know, you can't adjust very much now. It's kind of like this is the scope of it. It needs to be steady because it's used in an awful lot of deployments. But you as a consumer, is that affecting you in any way? Or, you know, do you have any sort of, oh, I wish this was going on, or are you just happy? I mean,
yeah, I guess I am happy. I mean, sometimes I'm doing some like things in the API views that don't feel like the most correct way. Perhaps when I need some extra data to, I don't know how to do it via the get query set method, but I think that's more down to me not having enough experience to, you know, implement it correctly and not to the design of the Django REST framework.
I have to mention, so your master's thesis was around augmented reality, goggles and everything. Do you what are your thoughts on that? Because I haven't tried them on. I'm completely ignorant. But it seems potentially very cool.
Yeah, I mean, I've tried to like read and perhaps get some impressions from other devs on like Mastodon and other social media, and I think the Apple had some like these labs where you can apply and they will invite you to have in-person demo, and I think these last for 5 hours or something. But I'm just not really interested in the goggles because I'm not sure what the use case would be for me. I mean, in the past I was more interested in the like the VR stuff, like the, you know, the Oculus Quest or the other ones, because of the fitness, say, apps or games to have some like exercise perhaps during winter. But apart from these use cases, I'm not sure what would be the, you know, the selling point for me. So
yeah, fair enough. I mean, it seems certainly at the price point, it seems for businesses. So maybe military, maybe doctors training or something. But it's in terms of, you know, I heard some people say like for meetings, it could replace in-person meetings. But yeah, well, I guess we'll see. I mean, it's all those things, if they work out, they come down to consumers at some point. But it's sort of hard to put something that blinds you. Or I guess it doesn't blind you, right? That's the thing. It doesn't. You can still see around, but just to put something on your head.
Some kind of pass-through view, I think. But, you know, the reveal was in June, so it's been some time since I watched their keynote.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, well, let me ask you about something else then. So Carlton, you had to say something.
No. I was just going to pop in. I think, you know, if you talked about the price point there, it's like a lot of money to replace a video call, you know, it seems. But depending on the quality of it, it's not a lot of money compared to a big display. You want one of these 27-inch cinema displays, they're more money. Now, if the goggles are able to produce a screen quality resolution, which, you know, I read an article claiming they wouldn't be able to, but, you know, that was based on that wasn't from someone who actually used them. But if that's capable, then they could be cheaper than a couple of pro displays, and it might be the way forward there. So that was just one thought that...
Yeah, that's actually one of the use cases. I think some of my developer friends mentioned that, you know, you can have like these 6 MacBook screens in front of you instead of, you know, with the goggles. But, you know, for me, I'm still only able to focus on one. So I don't have the need to have more screens around me, because I can, for me, it's like I can just as easily toggle like the windows on the single screen than to look around and to find where that window is. So I don't know.
Yeah, no, anyway, just go on.
I was going to ask, so you have so many projects. It's very impressive. ImpressKit, can you tell us about what ImpressKit is?
That's a bit difficult because, you know, it's been live for 2 years almost, and I still don't have like this one sentence pitch for it.
That's okay.
It's basically for me and for other indie developers, when you need to create a press kit, that's basically like a bunch of assets and some descriptions about your app or game. Because then if you want to get in touch with the journalists, it helps to, you know, give them all the information and like this press ready assets that are perhaps not edited or in higher resolution. So I've basically built a kind of a CMS that's dedicated to creating these press kits, and it's even more focused for, or rather on the iOS apps and perhaps Mac ones too, but there are like some subtle features or tweaks that make it like even more suitable for the iOS ones. For example, if you create one, then it will also give you this download on the App Store badge, or generate a QR code that the journalist can scan from their laptop to, you know, try the app out. And there are some like image optimizations where it automatically resizes the image when you upload it, so it's not, you know, it's not too large, and the journalist doesn't have to waste time downloading like 10 megabytes of single PNG and then resize it themselves. Yeah, so that's basically it. And there's also some like support for a press release, which is kind of a like a blog post, but it's aimed to at the press, not like at the general like public. So that's that. And that's, I think, the convoluted pitch that I just came up with, but I hope it makes sense.
I mean, press kits are important and a pain to create and to use as a journalist and others. So having an easy way to manage that makes a lot of sense. And to have, you know, images, like you want to have the best images. You don't want to, If you've ever built a press kit for a website or something else, it makes sense. So.
But I think it's good go on, Karen.
Yeah, to say yes, you know, devs often do like these, they like zip files that they just upload somewhere, and that's also pain for the journalists to use because they have to download it, and perhaps, you know, then the CDN is slow that day, or I don't know, it's just named press kit without the name of the app, and they have like 10 identical press kit folders in their downloads, and I have to look for it. So that's also motivation for this project.
But it also acts as like a checklist, right? So if I'm an indie dev, I have no idea about what I have to put in a press kit. Whereas if I go to ImpressKit, I can, it's got like, you know, you upload this image, write this text, you know.
Yeah, that's right. This was the first time I was using webhooks. It always was like scary word for me. And then I realized it's basically, you know, request that's made by server and not a person, if that's like not too much simplification. So I've managed to build a webhook for the pedal service that I'm using for, you know, for the subscription that's needed to use it. So that was probably the most challenging part of the project. I think there's Stripe and this one. And when I was trying to figure out what to use, I basically discovered that with Stripe, you need to like handle all the like the taxes and other legal stuff. And this pedal is like, forgot the term, but they basically handle a lot more.
The like seller of records.
So you don't have to. Oh, yeah, that's the.
What is it, Carlton?
They're the seller of records. So for tax purposes, you buy it off of Paddle rather than off of Philippe. And then Paddle will pay out to
Yeah.
So it's a bit like Gumroad and the other one, I think, is called FastSpring, who are quite big in this space. And so you buy it off of FastSpring, or you buy it off of Gumroad, or you buy it off of Paddle rather than buying it off Philippe. So he doesn't have to do the tax.
Right. Well, yeah, Stripe is slowly adding all these features in, so I think eventually they'll get there. But I was actually looking yesterday, because I remember when I looked 2 years ago, it was like Paddle was like, yeah, we handle all that, and Stripe was like, that's your problem. And so I was like, okay. So it seems like the smart move for now, for sure, because yeah, Stripe keeps every update. They have new tax features, but that's a question for you. I mean, so I guess all three of us were indie developers in our own way, like just the business of selling things online is more cumbersome, I think, than people think. Like it's probably easier than it's ever been. And yet there's all these, certainly in the United States anyways, like I have to set up certain legal entities, bank accounts, taxes, like there's all this stuff. For me, when I was getting started, I felt like it took almost 6 months just to handle all the administrative business side that I wasn't even aware of. It was like the price of some degree of success. I don't know. Is it any easier for you, or does that ring true? Just all this cruft around, like, why is it so hard? Everything's built for big businesses to do.
Yes. I mean, it's kind of easy now because I have some, I don't know how to translate it to English, but I think it'd be something like the solo proprietor or something like that.
Yep. Yeah, that's what I am.
For my full-time job, I have like this kind of status, or I don't know what's the term for it, and this also lets me to, you know, have paid products, and thanks, you know, Paddle and App Store being this, you know, is that word that Carlton said, you know. So, but yeah, I mean, I had my own apps on the store for like 10 years, and I've only had paid once for the last two because it was always so intimidating, and I was afraid to, you know, mess something up and then either got fined or, you know, something else. So,
When I looked into this, and again, this is definitely not tax advice, but most of the rules around collecting taxes like abroad or in countries other than your own, you need to be at a level that it would seem like it was six figures. So like 100,000, like it was a high bar. So if it was just, anyways, don't take that tax advice, but the rules are not designed for small people. And it definitely helps to have a service like Gumroad or Paddle that will just handle it for you. That's all I had to say.
You know, I mean, I got exactly the same experience as that, you know, so I'm Autonomo in Spain, same thing as you've got, Philippe. And if I didn't have my hair store, who's my like accountant to do the quarterly returns, it would just be like an absolute, I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't be in business. There's just no way. And they know all the rules and they tell me exactly what I have to do and I do it. But it's still my dreaded day of the quarter when I have to do the paperwork for the accountant. It's like, oh no, not that day.
Well, let me ask about coding. So what are you excited about now? Like what's sort of interesting to you? Because you've done so many things. Is there something now, some tool or technique that is particularly interesting that you want to learn more about?
You mean like a new framework or like a
new design pattern? Yeah, anything.
I mean, you know, regarding to design patterns and all this new stuff, I think I kind of like moved away from it because in the past I used to like really follow all the new Swift features, which is the language that Apple primarily uses on their platforms. And I could probably name and explain every keyword, which now I cannot do also because they added like 30 more in the last 3 years. So I guess I'm now more focused like on really building stuff that other people can use, and I'm trying to like perhaps focus more on the UX side of things and UI, and also sometimes even a typography to, you know, to think like how the app looks and, you know, if the dialogues and the interactions make sense, and also the wording is problematic since I'm, you know, not native speaker, which is probably obvious at this point. No, in the podcast. English,
so. Well, I mean, you have an accent, but I wouldn't say by your word choice you're not a native speaker at all.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, but you know, it's also a bit difficult if you need some short like alert or some banner that explains some kind of feature to come up with the right word. So yeah, yeah. I guess I've been more focused on this, and also some like marketing or this app store optimization that you need to do, like to find the good keywords and like
keywords,
good
yep.
screenshots, which is annoying and, you know, boring, but there's no way to avoid it if you want to get any download. So
I feel like I'm in the same place too. Like you start off like loving the tech and can I build it? And then once you've built a certain amount of things, then you realize the marketing, the UI, the text, these are the things that matter a lot more than you thought that they do. and they do take time to do well. Yes, Carlton?
So both of you then, with that mindset in place, I just think, well, that makes Django perfect for you then, because Django's trustworthy, it doesn't break over time, you know, it's easy to update between versions, it's you know, the next time you come back to it, it's still the same as it was. You might have a new thing, but that new thing's not going to impinge on you until you need to get, you know, doesn't that make Django just the perfect choice when you're in that position of, hey, I'm focusing on other things?
Yeah, it does. That's why I use it, right?
I wonder how much is like a maturity thing, Carlton, right? Because on the Orange site, every year or something, people rediscover Django, and it's like, yeah, like you're not, are you really innovating? Like all these new frameworks, like that's great, and JavaScript, blah, blah, blah. But like, what are you actually trying to do here? It just feels like it's a tool. And if you want a tool, it kind of checks all the checks, you know, 95% of the boxes. I mean, this is something I've picked up because I've been mentoring some people, and people who are newer in their career, it's not that they think things are more complicated than they are, but they're just not aware of off-the-shelf solutions. So there's so many that, you know, they just don't know that the road that's been tread by all the other developers, and that if they ask the right question, there's generally a simple, elegant solution. It's just, can they find that for themselves? So very, very few things in web development are that hard if you know where to look, I guess is what I'm saying. And so I've had, this person, she was like, wait, it's not this. And I was like, no, I let her talk for 10, 15 minutes. And I was like, it's really just as simple as this. I think there's a lot of that with the years, you see that certain patterns, you know, work well, and yeah, don't fight the framework kind of thing. That's my TED talk.
Okay. We'll get you on stage.
Oh God. No. Well, maybe we can talk about, are there new features that are interesting? I mean, it's an iOS developer, or Carlton, I know, you know, 5.0 is coming out. That's something you're very excited about. Maybe for you, Philippe, like, does async matter to your work, or are there any features that, you know, we always ask if you could just wave a wand, is there something that Django could provide that would make your life easier?
I mean, if I could have like this one button deployment from PyCharm, perhaps like the Microsoft that, or perhaps they even have it now, right, from the Visual Studio, if you use their cloud service. And if you are locked in, you can, I think, still press button and it will, you know, do the deployment for you. I haven't used it in like 7 years, so it might be different now, but you know, any improvements towards deploying would be great. And probably it's also the case that if you use the platform as a service, it's much easier. That's what I'm doing. I've been using the simple VPS since my school days, why I didn't have, you know, budget for more like pricier solutions. So perhaps that would also solve my issues if I paid for Heroku, or what's the other one, the new one, that's the Fly or something.
Fly is one of the very popular ones. Yeah. I mean, Carlton, deployment. I mean, I want you to say something, but I think I've mentioned this before, you know, so starter projects, right? Like what is, you know, is there a market for a starter project like my Django X or something that is like one click and deploy on Heroku, Fly? I mean, all these platforms as a service, it's not too hard to handle the basic case of environment variables, static files. It's just hard to know if that's enough for someone who knows what they're doing. Because I feel like every deployment becomes custom at a point. But Carlton, please.
No, but this is exactly where I think the platforms as a service go. It's not they go wrong. They're brilliant for what they want to do. As long as you fit in the neat little box, then they are simpler. But as soon as you, I don't know, you want to add Redis server. And so, you know, I maintain the channels package. And the number one cause of tickets is people on, say, Heroku or another one who can't get the configuration right to configure the connection to Redis because it's, you know, a weird URL and they have to get this SSL correct and have to do all these things and they just don't know how. And whereas if you try and connect to Redis on localhost, nobody has ever, ever opened an issue saying, oh, I can't connect to Redis on localhost, right? Because that just never goes wrong. It just literally never goes wrong. And the trouble with the platform as a service is once you step out of that neat little, oh, you're just running your app box, you're suddenly into distributed systems because you're connecting to a database over the internet. You're connecting to Redis over the internet. You're connecting to some other search service over the internet rather than running it all on your VPS, which costs, you know, you scale up your VPS, maybe it costs you $10 a month and you're running, you know, the biggest box under the sun. That's an exaggeration. It's not the biggest box under the sun, but it's more than enough box for your website, right, is my point. And it's got Redis locally. It's got this, yes, it's slightly more complex to provision it that first time. Yes, you have to sort of keep it updated a little bit over time. But on average, as you scale your application, having a VPS with everything you want on it is a lot less effort than trying to configure, you know, matching services across, you know, HTTP connections which drop out on you for no reason and all the rest of it. I would argue. If it's literally just...
That's my experience because, you know, once I managed to finally, you know, deploy it for the first time, then, you know, it basically seems to run without issues and I can just update it with new code and update the Django and the other packages and it works from that point. But, you know, the initial deployment, if you get stuck and miss something, then it's...
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there are too many moving parts. So my idea with Barton is that you take a clean server and you run a script to get it ready for your app and then you run another script to get your app there and that's it. You know, there's no more, you know, no apt-get install sudo. Oh, I didn't do sudo. Oh, I've got to change the configuration file. Ah, where even is the configuration file? Where is the log file? None of all of that.
Just abstract it to Carlton and...
Well, no, but that's what I'm working on. I'm working on exactly that because I think, see the same problem again and again and again and again. It's people fighting to either go what I consider to be kind of a bit too simple with the platform as a service and then saving trouble for later, or getting stuck in this sort of mire of, there's too many moving parts. Like there has to be there's a big gap there that there has to be able to fill.
I think I've appreciated that newer platforms as a service, because there's a whole bunch of after Heroku ones, it's a really hard problem to solve. I mean, so like in my beginner's book, I switched to fly.io. I still have Heroku in my other two books. You know, Heroku is, you have to pay for it now, but it really just kind of works when they're not down, which they haven't been down for a while. So I've had occasions where I'm mentoring people and they just can't, I don't want to say names, but some of the newer options have had troubles and we're just like, you know what, like, let's just take 2 minutes and switch to Heroku and it just works. Again, this is a simpler use case. This is more toy projects, but yeah, just to reiterate, it's a hard, hard problem, right? Because for all these platforms as a service, there just seem to be so many edge cases around databases and connecting to other things. And I guess they have to cover all the main frameworks, right? Not just Django. So I have empathy for their challenges, but I hope they would just fix it.
Monumentally hard.
So one thing that I wanted to ask you is, you know, so the new iOS 17, or more generally, when you're dealing with iOS, they change pretty regularly, and it can be a hard thing, a moving target. Like, what is that like where you sit? Because way back, 10 years ago when I worked on the mobile app for Quizlet. It was deeply frustrating that they switched from iPhone 4 to iPhone 5, where the screen size changed, I think, for the first time. And so we all of a sudden on the App Store, we had a lot of users. We started getting all these one-star reviews on launch day because we didn't fit the new screen form, but Facebook, Google, and like a couple other big companies did. And we're like, well, no one told us. Like Apple didn't tell anyone about the changes, but we were getting punished for it. So it definitely felt like a closed system where it was the opposite of the web, right? Like we eventually scrambled and fixed it. But I find that, the closed systems of iOS, as powerful as it is, you're kind of at the, Apple just calls the shots and you have to move with them. So what's your experience been over the years using iOS is a long way of saying.
I mean, it's been pretty positive. I think I got lucky because I got into iOS when the Swift 3 was out, because I remember there was this big migration and changes from Swift 2 to Swift 3 when Apple changed lots of stuff, you know, at the language level. So I think, you know, people had to migrate a lot of code. And, you know, otherwise it seems fairly stable. Most of the new features you don't need to adopt right away. And even if there's something like the dark mode with iOS 13 or like some widget changes right now with the iOS 17, you know, until you, I think for most of these, until you compile with the new Xcode and upload new build, the, you know, stuff should work as before, even on the new iOS. So it doesn't break until you submit new version and forget to fix something. But yeah, there is this, you know, as we mentioned previously in the UI kit and Swift UI in iOS, you kind of have these two ways to build UIs. The UI kit is the older one, and that's, you know, that's much more stable, mainly because Apple also doesn't, you know, add much new stuff to it. But, you know, the Swift UI one, that's the declarative framework. It's sort of similar to perhaps the Flutter, that's the multi-platform one, or, you know, on the Android people, they have the Jetpack Compose or something like that. And basically the idea is that the UI is represented by state. So it, I guess the main benefit is that you cannot have these like bugs that are due to like missing synchronization between the data and the UI, where you would forget to like update button to say like success or disable it, and in the code or like in the logic it would be disabled but the screen would show something else. That's not present, but you know, since this is a new framework, Apple's been changing it quite a bit. And I think especially perhaps around navigation, where you have like the logic to move between screens, they've been changing this a lot with the Swift UI API. So that's, I think, currently the most like changed or unstable part of the iOS development. But otherwise, I think it's pretty good. You know, we get the first Xcode betas in June, right after their WWDC conference, where they announced the new, you know, operating systems and sometimes even the new hardware, like the goggles this year. And then in September, or late September, is the release date for all the platforms. So there's a couple of months to, you know, start working on new APIs and iron out compatibility issues and similar possible problems. So I think that's pretty nice experience overall.
Yeah, the summer's busy.
With the Swift UI, like one of the promises, and they all sort of like the all sort of have the same thing. If you go into the Microsoft worlds, there's the I can't even remember the MAUA.net framework, which is supposed to be multi-platform. You develop your UI once and then you can deploy it. And Apple tell this same story. You know, you can perhaps build your Swift UI for your iPhone, but it'll go to iPads easily and then onto the Mac easily. Do you find that, I mean, is it, it never seems as the great utopia that is promised in the marketing materials?
Yeah, it's definitely not there yet, I feel. I mean, between the iPhone and iPad, I think it's pretty close. And perhaps even with the watch, with the Swift UI, where like your components automatically adapt, you use this same picker or same button and it gets, you know, different UIs based on the platform. But, you know, then going with iOS code base to Mac is more difficult, and you have multiple choices like what to build. You can build this fully native app, you can do the Catalyst one, which is like iPad version with some like changes, and then you have this, I forgot the term, it's something like iPad apps for Mac, and that's like just this iPad app that runs on a on Mac with minimal changes, but that's also has some issues, and you can even detect it in code, so you cannot provide any customization for in this mode, I think.
And then the other thing people go for then is they end up building Electron apps because they want this kind of multi-platform. What's your kind of thought? Have you never been tempted that route? Because you've got Django, you can serve HTML with it, you're doing that for your Impress kit. You never thought, oh, I'll just stick a web view in here? And
not really, because I think it's you can pretty quickly see that the app is not native, you know, because
okay.
You can try to zoom it, or you can scroll up and down, and you see that it either, like, you know, it's janky or it's some kind of weird issue. I'm not sure if that's probably also part of the WebKit, or because I think I've read some like blog posts and similar where people say that Apple isn't like or doesn't have the incentive to improve Safari too much, or like the WebKit engine, but I'm not sure. That's more like it's just completely different, you know, technology. And
I think we have to be fair to, like, it seems to me at least that WebKit's come, or Safari's come on an awful lot in the last, say, couple of years. I say 2 years. There's been a big move forwards. I don't know. Okay, interesting. Thank you.
Well, maybe as a final question, when do you think the new Switch is going to come out, right? The Switch 2, the Pro, right? You have all the insight.
Yeah. That's a surprise question. Didn't expect this. I mean, the original one is quite old at this point. I think it was 2017, perhaps, when Nintendo launched the original Switch. So that's 6 years. And I think the standard like lifespan of these game consoles is perhaps 7 or 8. Not sure, you know, we didn't have many generations, even with the PlayStation and Xbox, and some were longer, some were shorter. So I guess I have no idea. And there were some rumors about, you know, this performance boost and this ray tracing and similar. I don't know, it feels weird to me because Nintendo never really like focused on performance, even with the older consoles and their handhelds. You know, they have completely different, I think, mindset, you know, for their games. And I think it also helps that, you know, Mario and all these like flagship titles, they have this like cartoon graphics, so they, you know, they don't need the performance to have these super realistic scenes and world. So I mean, I hope that, you know, for the new Switch and for it to be backwards compatible, so I can it will perhaps bring more interest to my app, you know, and there's new console that's sort of similar and it's not completely different.
Yeah, I remember when it first came out, they launched with the first Zelda, Breath of the Wild, and they sold more Breath of the Wild games than consoles, as I recall, which was sort of odd. I'm pretty sure that's the case. Anyways, we have one. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing what they can eke out of the performance.
I think, you know, regarding Zelda, that's probably the most embarrassing fact about, you know, me and Switch is that I've tried the first one and the Breath of the Wild, and it just wasn't a game for me. And when I tell this to someone who played it, they're like, what? How?
Well, you need all the time in the world is the problem. I would recommend, just going off topic, like Hogwarts Legacy is like my favorite game I've played in a long time. I'm not a big gamer, but it's coming out, I think, in a month or two, finally, on the Switch. So shout out to, you know, Ravenclaw.
Nice.
Hey, well, Carlton, I think we're out of time. Anything else you wanted to ask?
No, I was just going to bring up GoldenEye, but I won't.
Well, it's only on the streaming one, though, unfortunately. Yeah.
But I would have got that, but you said infinite time. It's like literally since children, my gaming time has evaporated into none.
Retirement years.
Yeah. I save it for when I'm retired. Philippe, thank you very much for coming on. It's really interesting to talk to you and to talk to how you're using Django, you know, in as the back end for your iOS apps. I think that's fascinating. And, you know, I hope you've enjoyed coming on.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for the invite. And hopefully at least some of what I said makes sense. So, and if anyone wants to, you know, ask me more questions or get in touch, like, feel free to send me an email or something. I think in the show notes there should be links perhaps to my blog that has the contact info. And yeah.
All right. Thanks very much. Well, we are, as ever, at DjangoChat.com, and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.